So we're looking at what I've perhaps slightly overdramatically called the cultural crisis of the church. And last week we looked at how over the last 50 years in Europe and North America there's been quite a sudden cultural shift away from Christianity. So that suddenly we found ourselves going from living in a Christian country to living in essentially a non-Christian country. Just one index of that, in 1950, around 75% of babies were baptized in the Church of England. Now it's around 10%. So within 65 years, we've gone from 75% being baptized in the Church of England, and some in other churches, obviously, to now about 10%. And the result of that is that the church is having to think about how to relate to a non-Christian culture in a way that it hasn't done for something like 1,500 years. And we looked at four different models of how the church can relate to the culture around us. And those are the four on the sheet. You'll see them there: transformationist, counterculturalist, relevance model, and the two kingdoms model. And I'm going to summarize those again briefly tonight. And what we'll see is that each of those models has biblical support. Each of them answers a question about how we relate in a helpful way. So each of them has very helpful things to teach us. But equally, what we're going to look at this time is the critiques, the failings of each of those models. And we'll see that none of them tells the full story. And then we'll think about how we reach a synthesis of them, what we learn from the four of them. So I'm going to go through them. Has everyone got the ability to see a sheet? Yeah? Okay, so the first is transformationist. This view says that Christians should be involved in every aspect of the world to change it for good. Abraham Kuyper, former Dutch Prime Minister's famous comment, "There is not a square inch of creation over which Jesus Christ does not proclaim, 'This is mine.'" Not a square inch of creation over which Jesus does not claim, "This is mine." And so Christians should be involved in trying to transform everything to make it more suitable for God's creation. Transformationists believe that Christians have a unique worldview, and as they bring that to bear on their work, whether it's as a doctor or as a dustman, it makes their work visibly different. And therefore, in our work and in everything we do, we shine the light of Christ and bring change for good in every part of creation. And direct political engagement tends to come under this category. So Christians who say we should take hold of power and use it for good. Now, underneath the summary of each point, I've put in italics some of the shortcomings, some of the criticisms we could make. Transformationists can sometimes seem rather overconfident in the ability to make the world better. They can be a little bit self-righteous. They think they've got the answer, a little bit triumphalist. They often claim they know exactly how Christian businesses should be run or how Christian art should be made. And they'll use passages in the Bible to justify that. But I think if you look at the Bible, it probably doesn't give us very clear blueprints for those kind of issues. And culture is complex and not controllable by any one means or group. The actual influence that Christians have in the world is often quite small and incremental. So the critics of transformationists say they put too much trust in politics as a way to change the culture. Transformationists say if we can get hold of the levers of power and pass laws, then things will change. But actually, I think we know that cultural change is far more complex than that. It tends to happen from the bottom up through artists and thinkers in ways that often we don't expect. So Jesus uses images like salt and light and leaven, things that operate quietly and often unnoticed. Critics say transformationists don't recognize the dangers of power. We heard in that reading that Jesus said to Pilate, "My kingdom is not of this world, so my followers don't fight to get hold of it. They don't use power. Jesus tells the disciples to put away their sword when they come to arrest him. And as Christians get absorbed by seeking power, often they lose their spiritual vitality and distinctiveness and get drawn into following the ways of the world. So the critics say that Christians rather should identify with the marginalized and the dispossessed. And when we do get hold of power, we tend to misuse it just like everyone else does. We're just as susceptible to the temptations of power as everyone else. And the last criticism of transformationists is that they are in danger of underappreciating the significance of the church. They think the real action is out there in the world, and so the church isn't that important. They put all their energy into bringing about social change rather than personal evangelism and nurturing believers. And if the kingdom of God is ultimately the place where Jesus is king, then the church is massively significant. Unless people are growing in their personal faith and recognizing Jesus' kingship, then the kingdom won't come around. But transformationists sometimes see the role of the church as secondary. Okay, so that's the first category. Then if you look down the same column, you'll see the second model, which is the relevance model. Now, this model sees Christianity as fundamentally compatible with culture. It says God is at work in all social movements that promote peace, justice, and the common good. And that is the case whether it's inside the church or outside the church. The role of the church, say the relevance people, is to engage and adapt to changes in the culture so that they can connect to what God is already doing in the world. Now, critics of that view say that when the church adapts to whatever the world changes, whatever changes in the world, then very quickly they become dated, because whenever the culture changes, the church tends to get left behind. So the church easily becomes out of date, as it says there. An example would be liberal Protestant churches in the 19th century that downplayed the supernatural, like personal conversion and miracles. And very quickly when they did that, the gospel began to lose its power to bring change and new life and hope to people. It means that Christian doctrine can become limitlessly negotiable, because the prevailing culture will always have the last word, so we'll never ultimately stand up for anything if the culture doesn't like it. And so the uniqueness of the unchanging truths and traditions of the church get lost. In this model, critics say the main energy of the church is not directed towards teaching the gospel and bringing people to faith, but in seeking social justice, producing music and art and things like that. And when the church puts most of its energy into those things, people will say, well, often people outside the church do that much better, so what really is the point of the church? Again, what happens out there in the world is seen as more important than what happens in the church. And so the church loses its central role in God's purposes. So then we go on to the third model, which is up on the right-hand side, and that is counterculturalism. And that is kind of the opposite of the relevance model. Counterculturalists see the church as a contrast society to the world. The world, it says, will always be characterized by greed and selfishness and by the strong misusing their power. And so the church should be the opposite of that. We shouldn't expect to produce any great change in the world, because the world is always dominated by sin and selfishness. So the church's role is to be a counterculture, a sign of a different way to live. If there is a cultural crisis for the church, these people say, it's because the church has stopped being the church and has been corrupted by a materialist Western consumerism. So I don't know whether that's something that you are naturally sympathetic to. Partly perhaps it's to do with our personality or our experience. You know, you might say Baptists very strongly would identify with that kind of countercultural model. the church must be very different from the world. Now, the critics say that kind of disengagement from the world is too pessimistic about the prospects of bringing change. To take an obvious example, William Wilberforce, through his determination and engagement with politics and the world, coming entirely from his Christian faith, achieved an amazing change that affected the whole world in the abolition of slavery. On a bigger scale, Christianity changed the whole of Western culture. It changed it away from a pagan culture, which emphasized honor and pride and loyalty to your tribe and revenge, and it changed it to a Christian culture which valued humility, forgiveness, and the value of every human being as being made in God's image. So counterculturalists can be too pessimistic about the prospects of bringing change in the world. Also, the counterculturalist model can tend to demonize modern business and capital markets and governments. Almost all business people are seen as greedy and materialistic, and governments are seen as bent on violence. And counterculturalists can become almost obsessed by their opposition to those aspects of Western society. They claim not to be involved in politics, but actually they become almost more political than other Christians as they attack their opponents using often very political language. And then the last criticism is that counterculturalists can fail to appreciate how much all of us are influenced by our culture, whether we like it or not, whether we realize it or not. There is no pure Christian culture. And if you want to an illustration of that, think about how different Chinese Christians are from British Christians. You know, Chinese Christians will be enormously influenced by Confucianism and by the history of communism and so forth. British Christians, though we may not realize it, are essentially, Western individualists living in a very materialist culture, very different from Chinese Christians. So there is no cultural neutrality. And counterculturalists perhaps deny the way that culture influences the church. And then the final group, which is the two kingdoms model. And people who follow this model say that God rules his creation in two different ways. There is first a common kingdom, the kingdom of the world, where God, through common grace, keeps the world going, sends the rain on the good and the evil, restrains sin, and gives people who are made in his image an innate understanding of right and wrong. So Christians, like everyone else, are part of that kingdom, and we should be involved working alongside our non-Christian neighbours, working for the common good. This group say there's no fundamental difference between a good Christian doctor and a good atheist doctor, or between a good Christian dustman and a good atheist doctor, dustman. A good dustman is a good dustman, a good doctor is a good doctor, regardless of whether they have faith or not. There is a difference between a good doctor and a good dustman, I should point that out. So that's one kingdom, the common kingdom of this world, and we're all involved in that. But then they say there's a second kingdom, which is effectively the church, people who've come to faith in God, and only Christians are members of that kingdom. And so building up that kingdom through evangelism and discipleship is true kingdom work. The problem that the people in this group say is when we get the two kingdoms mixed up. We shouldn't expect to make the world Christian because it's a different kingdom. And it's only where Christ is king in people's hearts that we will really be part of God's kingdom. Well, again, the critics of this model say there are things wrong with it. They say it gives more weight than the Bible to common grace, i.e. God working out in the world through his general care for people, gives more weight to that than the Bible does. It assumes that Christians don't need to bring their unique understanding of God and the Bible to the world because the world can be kept healthy through natural revelation, through what everyone knows of God through creation. Now that seems to go beyond what the Bible teaches, which is that usually human beings distort and suppress the natural revelation that God gives us. Many of the good things in the world, the critics say, have in fact come from a distinctively Christian influence. The very idea of human rights, we tend to think that's a universal thing, but actually that came out of a Christian worldview. It came out of the idea that all people are made equally in God's image. And that has come to have a worldwide influence, replacing things like communism, but it certainly came out of a Christian worldview and probably could only have come out of a Christian worldview. The Two Kingdoms model also assumes that the state should be merely secular or neutral and just there to restrain evil. But actually, it's impossible in reality for a state to be morally neutral. Every judgment we make is based on some understanding of right and wrong, of what is valuable and of the purpose for society. No government in reality can purely restrain evil and be morally neutral. And although the Bible doesn't give us detailed rules on how to live, it does speak very clearly about a whole range of cultural and economic and artistic elements and ethical issues. And they affect every aspect of life. So the idea that these kingdoms are very separate is probably naive. It took a long time to abolish slavery, but you could argue that it was in the end inevitable because of the impact of the values the Bible teaches. Not because of people's natural instincts, but because of the Christian salt and light beginning to affect the whole world. The Two Kingdoms model, the critics say, also produces a form of social quietism. In other words, people say, I can't really change anything, so I won't get involved, I'll just stay separate. And so the church retreats into its own little spiritual Indian reservation and doesn't engage with the world. And this model can also encourage a different way of valuing work in the world as opposed to work for the kingdom. Although it says Christians should excel in their vocations in the world because it is God's world, it says it's not true kingdom work. And the church and therefore the clergy are rather more important than everyone else. And I don't think that's a Christian understanding of the priesthood of all believers, which says that all our ministries are valuable and precious in the sight of God. So excess focus on clergy and the church is perhaps the shortcoming of that view. So I think as we look at these four different views, we see they all contain valuable biblical insights, and yet no one fully answers the question of how we should relate to our culture, partly because there isn't a simple answer. You'll see I've put at the top little common grace and at the bottom full of common grace. So the two top views, transformationist and counterculturalist, see that there's little common grace in the world. It all depends on Christians and their witness. The two views at the bottom, relevance and two kingdoms, say there's a lot of common grace. People know a lot of God without hearing from Christians. And then if you look at the left-hand side, you'll see I've put active in culture. Transformationists and relevance people think we should be very engaged in the world out there. And on the right-hand side, I've put passive about culture. So counterculturalists and Two Kingdoms people say we shouldn't worry too much about the culture around us. We should just concentrate on building up the church. So you can see this is a matrix of different approaches to the world. Now, I'm going to give you a chance to comment. I know that's a lot to cover, and particularly if you weren't here last week. It might be quite hard to take in, but any questions or comments at this stage?
Keep it simple. Minimalism, sacred planet.
Yeah. So which view is that, Stuart?
I'm not sure.
I mean, I think you're a counterculturalist. You would say we should live a very different way and it should be a sign to the world because we live so differently. The original, I mean, what I said last time was that the first thinking on this was a book by Richard Niebuhr in 1956 called Christ and Culture. And he offered five models. And this is a slightly, it puts two of them into one of the models. So So this is a slightly simplified version. I mean, you can have as many models as you like, but this is the most helpful kind of simplification of it that I can come up with, Andrew. Well, that's a good question. It's important because it helps us to think about how we relate to the world. I mean, I'll just give you an example of that. I was talking to somebody in a church nowhere near here about baptism recently, and we have a very different baptism policy from them. And it's easy to think that that's because we have a different theology of baptism. But actually, I think we have exactly the same theology of baptism. What we have is a different theology about how to relate to the world. And often we don't realize that this issue about culture is actually what's controlling what we do. So if you think about the hymns we sing or the kind of services we have, actually it's not an issue about the services. It's an issue about how do we engage with the world around us? Do we change in order to be like the world, or do we stay as we are and try to be something different? So I think this actually affects, you know, pretty much everything we do. And yet often we're not aware of it. It's not an issue. I mean, it's an issue I've hardly thought about consciously in the last 20 years, which I think is very interesting, and yet it affects everything.
It is why some people gravitate to one kind of church or another.
Yeah, yeah. Go on, Anne, you were going to say something?
Actually, I didn't put my hand up.
Oh, didn't you? Yeah.
Jesus also says, go out and preach the gospel, you know, don't hide to that.
Sure.
If they hate you, they'll hate.
So if you're saying we're very different from the world, you'd be over on this side, yeah?
Sorry?
You'd be over towards this side that says we want to be a counterculture, we want to be different. The two kingdoms and the counterculturalist people are over there. There are other people who would want to be over this side and say we've actually got a lot, you know, we're a lot similar to the world. And, you know, I think you can make arguments for both. I'm gonna go on and say a bit more about that.
What do you think historically the church has been? Has it been all over the place, or has it historically been one place?
So John's asking where the church has been historically. Well, what I'm going to say shortly, you'll see I've put spring, winter, summer, and autumn. And one of the things I'm going to argue is that church, if you look historically, is often in a different relationship to culture. So I'll try and come on and answer that question.
Okay.
Because I think it varies a lot depending on the culture we're in. You see, some cultures are very open to Christianity and some are very hostile. So, you know, our relationship to culture will vary depending where we are, won't it? Any other comments at this stage? People on the side are allowed to contribute.
Why would you think that Christianity would...
Well, that's a very interesting question, isn't it? I mean, you know, this isn't in my notes, but one thing is that where there's a very strongly established religion, the culture tends to be less open to Christianity, which is quite interesting. But I mean, if you take, for instance, China, I mean, I had an email today or yesterday from a friend of mine who's working in Sheffield with overseas students, particularly Chinese, and he's talking about how incredibly open they are to Christian things and how interested and how receptive, and he contrasts that with British students who don't want to know and you can't communicate with them. Because the Chinese culture is much more open to Christianity at the moment than we are. And I'll say a bit more about that. Jonathan?
Don't you think, though, that he's dealing with a selective group of folks who are prepared to travel out there and want
Yeah.
to protect a particular
sample? Sure. Although it's interesting that China is generally, even in China, there's much more openness to Christian things, isn't there? And I'm going to argue that China is an example of spring, and spring is when the church is growing and developing. Maybe I should come on to that in a second. Any other comments? Go on, Stuart.
I think our situation is absolutely dire at the present. We're on the brink of a nuclear catastrophe, either by weapons. In fact, we're using nuclear weapons for the military. We use tactical weapons near Kiev, and we use tactical weapons
So how should the church engage with that? Okay. So you're a counterculturalist. Okay. I'm going to go on a bit and then there'll be a bit more chance to comment. You'll see that I've put under the four of them redemption, fall, restoration, and creation, because I think each of these four reflects a different aspect of the whole Christian story of God's interaction with the world. And I'm sure you know that that story has four stages. Firstly, creation. God made everything. He made everything good. Then fall. All human beings have rebelled against God and rejected him. Then redemption. Jesus comes as God's rescue mission to redeem, to put the world right. And then lastly, restoration, when one day God will restore all things to the way that they were meant to be. So if we look at those four, firstly, creation. That says the earth is not an accident or the result of a power struggle between different deities. It's all God's good work. And so human beings are commanded to care for and to cultivate the world. All human work comes under that creation mandate. God's grace and goodness is found in all people, whether they're believers or unbelievers, because everyone is created in God's image. So I think two kingdoms probably reflect creation. So the world is good, but that's not the end of the story, because the world is fallen. And sin affects everything, not just our hearts as individuals, but our whole cultures that we live in. Somebody said, nothing straight was ever made out of crooked timber. So we're living in a fallen world, and it will never be put right until Jesus returns. And of course, Christians too are fallen, but at least we know we're fallen. So our role is to be a sign to the world of a different way to live as we demonstrate our distinctiveness. So I think the counterculturalist approach emphasizes the fall. Then the next stage is redemption. The kingdom of God begins to come in Jesus Christ. The kingdom of God is among you, he says to his disciples in that Luke reading. But it comes quietly like a seed. It's growing, but lots of people don't notice it. A new people, a holy nation, the church is created. And the job of the church is not just to look after itself, but to bless and affect everything around it, to be salt and light in the world. And that process of redemption is gradual, like leaven working its way slowly through the whole dough. So transformationists reflect redemption. And then the final stage is restoration. In the end, God will put everything right and everything will be renewed. And there'll be ultimately no ultimate divide between the sacred and the secular, between the church and the world. And that's what the relevance model is looking forward to. So you could argue that each of these models stresses one stage of the Christian story, from creation to fall to redemption to restoration. But of course, each of them is incomplete on their own. And as I've already said, different cultures at different times respond very differently to Christianity. Some cultures are strongly influenced by Christianity, like our own. Others are very hostile. So Richard Niebuhr, who I mentioned earlier, he argued that Christians' relation to culture went through three stages. At the start, Christianity was alien to the culture, then it influenced it and became fully involved in it, and then the third stage, it became corrupted by the culture, became like the culture, and it had to then have a reformation and start again back at the first stage. And of course, there's some truth in that, but I think history is a bit more complicated than that. So another helpful way to look at it is to look at it as four seasons. And I've put them on here as well, as you see. I put question marks because I think you could argue about which one falls into which category. But let's just think about those four seasons. Firstly, winter. When it's winter, the church is in a hostile relationship with culture and is making little progress. It's embattled and feels vulnerable. It's often very persecuted. For instance, Christians in Islamic cultures today, they have no choice really other than to be counterculturalist and just be completely different and separate to the culture around them. So that's winter, that's the counterculturalist model. Then spring, the church maybe is still quite alien, still persecuted, but it's growing and it's having a kind of undercover influence. As I said, China today, post-communism, the church is not fully accepted, but lots of people are really listening to it and open to it, and there is quite rapid growth in the church in China. So that's the transformation stage, when the church is really having an impact on the culture around it. Then we get to summer, when the church is highly regarded, the culture becomes Christian. Christians are at the center of all cultural life, like Europe in centuries past, or perhaps many African countries today, when it's quite hard to tell the difference between Christian culture and the culture around us. And that matches the relevance model. Christianity is involved in and influencing everything. And then the final one is autumn, where people feel Christianity is past it, and it's ignored and marginalized, and most people aren't interested. And guess what? That's pretty much where we are today, isn't it? And so we're involved in the world through our work, and we want to do that well, but we often feel we're not having much impact on the culture because the culture doesn't want to know. And I think that matches the two kingdoms model. Now, none of those fit perfectly, which is why I put a question mark after it. But I think it's quite helpful to see that you can't have one size fits all model for how Christianity relates to culture, because culture's response to Christianity may be completely different in China today from South America, from Africa, from the UK, from North America.